You're listening to the Firefighter Success Podcast. Join us as we learn from successful firefighters and fire service leaders on how to achieve excellence. When lives depend on us, success is our only option. Welcome back to the Firefighter Success Podcast for another great episode. I'll be your host, and I'm also the author of Firefighter Success, Jim Moss. Now, today's podcast is definitely going to be a fun one because we have one of the most influential leaders in all the modern fire service. He is the real deal when it comes to being a champion of leadership and especially training, and he is someone who truly lives out the principles of firefighter success. Chief Kurt Isaacson is a 30-plus year veteran of the fire service with experience working in volunteer, career, and combination departments in urban, suburban, rural, and countywide settings. He is currently a battalion chief for Escambia County Fire Rescue in Florida, where he has worked for the last 21 years. And before his time with Escambia, Kurt was a company officer with the Pensacola Fire Department assigned to Heavy Rescue 31 for 9 years. And lastly, he is the founder of County Fire Tactics, an amazing resource for firefighter training with popular conferences such as Water on the Fire, High Rise Operations, Command Officer Boot Camp, and the Fire Conference coming in 2023. County Fire Tactics is making a huge impact on the fire service. Chief, welcome to the Firefighter Success Podcast. I'm so glad we finally made this happen.
Awesome, brother. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I love, you know, talking about the fire service, you know, leadership and tactics. You know, it's really basically all I know. I'm learning a little bit about American football with two of my kids, you know, going to UF and being a part of a SEC school. But outside of recent education, self-education on SEC and American football, I'm pretty much all firefighting.
I know that. Well, awesome. Well, let's get rolling. So what would you say is your definition of success and what is the best way to go about achieving it, particularly in the fire service?
Well, first and foremost, success has in the fire service, success is not connected to rank. And so many times you see people that they view success in a fire service based on how many bugles you have or what shirt you wear. The reality is if you're getting into the fire service, and I'll say our country, American fire service, you know, you don't get into it to get rich. If you know, you're looking for money and money's your motivator, hopefully you're doing something else other than the fire service. You know, not that you can't make a good living, but success really is longevity. I'll say that again. You know, success in the fire service for me is, you know, the definition will be longevity of enjoyment. You know, quite frequently when I speak, I refer to the 33-year first grade school teacher, fifth grade school teacher, whatever it is, that they're still excited 33 years into being, you know, a first grade school teacher, fifth grade school teacher, and they're still getting ready, you know, in August around Labor Day to start the school year. So I think that would be the most significant thing is success is happiness and longevity in the fire service and enjoying it to where you're kind of wondering how you're going to handle it when that last day comes, when you walk out of the firehouse and your time is completed in the American Fire Service.
Well, I would definitely say that you are truly the embodiment of your own definition. With 30 plus years in the fire service, you are still as passionate, maybe even more passionate and excited, enjoying what you're doing and teaching other firefighters. So I love when people hold true to their own values and their own definitions, like you did for success. Right there, you knocked it out of the park. You're living out your passion every day, and it shows with all you're doing to pour into others. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is to definitely talk about leadership, one of the other things that you're passionate about in addition to training. But when it comes to specifically leadership success, you know, if we had to boil it all down to the basic, most essential qualities of successful leaders, what would you say that they are?
You know, for me, longevity, same thing as number one. And just backing up for a second, I'll give you an example of number one just for a second before I answer number two is, you know, a good example of the definition of success would be a friend of mine that does a lot of working with us, part of the CFT team, is Todd Edwards. Made it to assistant chief at headquarters at the Atlanta Fire Department, was demoted back to captain on a very, very busy, if not the busiest engine company in Atlanta, going to a lot of fires. And on his last day, his last tour, shift, watch, whatever you refer to it, he actually trained with his company as a captain on a rig. And, you know, that's the definition of success, where, you know, you've made it to a staff chief position, you've been a battalion chief, now the organization has demoted you back to a company officer, and you're still smiling, and it's legit. You're training, you're drilling, you're just excited to still wear the shirt, be in the fire department, be a part of the fire service, and the brotherhood. So, you know, if somebody's looking for a definition definition of success in the fire service, a guy like, you know, Todd Edwards is just a great example. But, you know, what are the essential qualities of successful leaders? You know, I think the big thing is, you know, doing the right thing, do what's right. You know, Lou Holtz, longevity, that when, you know, I like to refer to Matthew McConaughey's book, Green Lights. In his book, Matthew McConaughey talks about when you lay your head down at night, only you know your internal thoughts. I mean, even your significant other, Lantia, really doesn't know your deeper inner thoughts. And, you know, if you as a firefighter, regardless of rank, are in it for the right reasons, and you're wanting to be a strong leader, and let's go back once again, leadership and being a leader in a fire service is totally separate from rank. You know, some of the senior firefighters, firefighters with purpose and passion, provide more leadership than company officers or chiefs. But, you know, the big qualities is going to be longevity and commitment and consistency, you know, and like with consistency, because, you know, there's a million books out there about integrity and character and loyalty and all that other stuff. But I think in a fire service for us as leaders, and I've failed in this, you know, quite a bit over my career, as I've been on a journey for emotional intelligence, and it's been a long journey for me. One big reason I took a break from the doc videos, but I think the biggest, most important thing in a fire service and leadership, regardless of rank, would just be consistency. That, you know, you don't burn out. You know, it can't be that firefighter that doesn't, you know, buckle up, pack out, two hands, two tools, go into an activated fire alarm. You get promoted, and all of a sudden you're wanting to get in somebody's butt, you know, write them up because they're not doing what you just didn't do last week when you were a firefighter. So, you know, people are going to see through that consistency. You look at, you know, anybody outside the fire service that has longevity, it's going to be consistency. So, you know, those two things, consistency, you know, over a long period of time in the fire service. And so many times you see people that they're chasing rank, and they'll jump from fire department to fire department, or they have and don't get me wrong, I think you should know what classes you need for the next position. But if all you're doing is trying to build a resume, you're really not going to get there. You know, the resume should build itself based on your purpose of loving the fire service, your purpose of being the best you can be, not better than anybody else. You know, it's you know, critical that you yourself are comparing yourself to you yesterday and today to be a better tomorrow. The big guy that does the motivational talks, I can't think of his name, but
Tony Robbins.
Yeah, Tony Robbins. I was watching a thing the other day about Tony Robbins when he interviewed Michael Jordan, and Michael Jordan not getting, you know, they say he didn't get picked for his high school team. He made JV. He did make the team. He just didn't make the varsity team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all he ever did was compete with himself. And, you know, you don't have to like Michael Jordan. You don't have to like Tom Brady. I mean, you know, you can't hate him. That'd be like hating greatness. But if you look at, you know, somebody like Tom Brady or Michael Jordan, at the end of the day, those two individuals, I don't think they were necessarily born with, you know, any more talent than anybody else. I think they just happen to put in more time than anybody else. You know, right now it's big. Everybody's, you know, questioning Tom Brady and what, you know, quitting football and his family and all that. That's none of our, you know, here or there. At the end of the day, as firefighters, fire officers are studying leadership, you want to study somebody, study Tom Brady. His purpose and passion is gone beyond anything. It has nothing to do with money. He has more money than he's ever going to, spend, but it's just putting in that extra time for those, I don't talk about it much because it seems like not many people understand the biggest sport in the world is soccer. But, for anybody that knows Ronaldo and Messi, Messi was born, I think, with more talent just born. God-given talent was given to Messi. Ronaldo is literally, consumed with what he eats and working out and everything he does, but if Messi and Ronaldo put in the exact same amount of time, I think you would see Messi would be way above and beyond. Not that Messi doesn't do what he has to do to play at the level he does, but those are things that you yourself have to look in the mirror and say, yeah, I'm good at what I do, but could I be better? Am I putting in, the consistency of always trying to be a better version of yourself? And, those are things, because if you can't lead yourself, you can't lead anybody else. And, like Visguso says, you got to lead one to lead many. Well, before you even lead one, you got to lead yourself. That's, so critical. And, we all, I think, struggle in life at leading ourselves. Hopefully we have somebody that's, open and honest and gives us direction, but we're looking to always, fine tune that long term.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So just to summarize, again, you hit on longevity and integrity was part of that too, of doing the right thing for the right reasons. If you do those things, you'll gain the respect, you'll gain the reputation and credibility from others. So when you want to go from being a firefighter to maybe an engineer or even a company officer, that's going to carry over on the next level and the next rank. And then also commitment, consistency, and leading by example are just quintessential qualities that you spoke about for successful leaders. And you started to dive into a little bit, but I want to pick your brain and ask you for all the aspiring leaders out there who are listening, the new officers, the new leaders, what would you say is the best piece of advice that you could give them?
Well, fire service wise is love the job. It is that simple. It is like, if I was lecturing right now, I'd tell you to pull out your pen and write that down and circle it. love the job. And it would be all capital letters, because I'm not the grammar police. And I like to make their head spin, but you got to love the job. If you got into this job because you're just trying to fast track it to the chief of department, you're trying to get more bugles or wear a white shirt, that's not it. You have to love the job first and foremost. You're going to get more return, more enjoyment out of it, and that's the deal. And there's nothing wrong with loving the job. It's sad that so many places that people still ridicule in the firehouse, somebody for being on vacation, they want to stop by a firehouse to, see what rigs they have or talk to a firefighter, or they wear fire department t-shirts on their days off. Like, what else? Why wouldn't you be that way? It's just amazing that more people are not into this job. And if they're not into it, then pick something else. And as I've matured, I'm totally okay with people having hobbies, hunting, fishing, playing golf. As long as you're into the job, when you're at work on duty, that's what's, most important. But anybody listening that, wants to be the best leader in the fire service, don't be too cool for school. Don't worry about, being, nerdy, geeky, a squirrel, a fire bug. that's how you become successful. To go back to number one is, and success is not about rank, but you become successful because you know this job inside and out. You can talk about it without looking at a book, and it's what you do. And you don't necessarily have to wake up and go to bed every day thinking about the fire service, but it does help in return because you're good at it. And the better you are. I mean, I had 6 fires in the last 5 days that I worked. And for me, when I'm going to a fire, I'm excited. I don't want anybody's stuff to burn. I don't want, I'm not looking for somebody to lose their stuff. But if it's going to happen, I want to be on duty. I want to go, because I'm so entrenched in this. I want to be able to use my skills and ability. I want to be able to not only apply, you know, whatever physical attributes I might have to offer, but my mental aspect of just thinking complex about coordinated fire attack, when to take the windows, when not, when to force the back door, what size hose line. You know, and when I pulled up day before yesterday, we had a multiple alarm commercial fire. When I'm pulling up, my brain's racing 100 miles an hour because of years of just studying and trying to make that, you know, as Dr. Klein in his book, you know, time compressed decision making. Mm-hmm. And that's where you're really showing your leadership, regardless of rank, when you pull up on a fire ground and everybody sees you as someone that's going to soften the fire ground, soften the building, make it, you know, less reactive, because you're going to have, you know, the right thoughts of what needs to be done. You know, obviously the strategic way to go about mitigating the incident, but tactically, in what order do we need to do things? And that's leadership. That's fire ground leadership, you know, regardless of rank. It could be just two firefighters operating and force the back door. And when they force it, one of them knows that once they force it, they don't want to open it. They're just forcing it to compromise the lock, and they're going to shut it on a tool or shut it on a chalk or whatever. And that's leadership. Just providing that, you know, direction, if you will. And we definitely could use some more of that in the fire service, that people on the fire ground, you know, are ready to rock and roll. You look at the helicopter rescue in Atlanta over 20 years ago, where Matt Mosley was hanging from the helicopter, and he talked at FDIC, you know, 20 years ago on the big stage, and he was the one hanging from the helicopter because he was the leader. He was the first guy that had his harness on, and he was ready to go to work.
That's right.
That's plain and simple. Ray McCormack, as the human body harness holding Kevin Shea on one of the most famous rescues in the FDNY, Ray had his harness on. He was wearing a harness, you know, pull up boots, but had a harness over. Like, and we still have firefighters that'll make fun of other firefighters because they're wearing a harness. And you could be a one station suburban fire department, there's still a potential that that harness is going to make the difference between life and death, or being on duty or off duty, being injured for a fellow firefighter, much less a civilian. So those are all leadership things that sometimes I think we pass over, that we get so hung up in what I would call corporate America, you know, corporate America leadership, where, and I think there are some parallels to the military leadership, but I think the fire service is in a world of its own too. You know, the military is a little different on how they leaders move around and around the world, not just, you know, they don't stay at one base. You have to be more consistent as a leader in the fire service than you do the military, because you possibly could lead somebody for 10, 15, 20 years. You're definitely, if you stay in the same fire department, do a career, you're going to have the same individuals watching you for multiple decades. You're not going to have that ability to relocate to a different base or a different, you know, corporate office, where now you're introducing yourself and you get a clean slate. Unless you change fire departments, you don't get a clean slate. It sticks with you forever.
Right. One of the things that popped into my head when you said love the job, as one of your best pieces of advice for aspiring leaders out there, one of the things that popped in my head was love your current position, right? And be the best you can at your current position. It's good to be thinking about the next position, maybe the next rank, and how you're going to reach that level. This really comes back to one of the first qualities you talked about, is being competent, consistent, committed to your current position, so that that can be your stepping stone, that can be your foundation when you are ready to promote to the next level. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. This January, I will have been Battalion 2, will have been my call sign at Escambia County Fire Rescue here in Northwest Florida. 19 years. I will have been a battalion chief assigned to Battalion 2 in Escambia County Fire Rescue for 19 years. So, you know, I can't afford to get bored. Do I have lulls? Do I have ups and downs? Yes. Right now, I'm literally the happiest I've been at Escambia County Fire Rescue, the happiest I've been as a line battalion chief in over a decade. And that's no secret on the job. I tell people that, you know, I had a great time being at work for 122 hours straight. It helped that we were going to fires and extrications, but I'm just, you know, I'm in a mental place right now where I'm on a high. And, you know, people ask me all the time, how do I consistently long-term stay in love with the job, be into the job? And I wouldn't say I'm always on top. You know, I've had lulls, I've had downs. It does help, though, that I associate and hang out with other people that love the fire service. You know, it's just like, you know, if you hang out with, single, if you're a male and you hang out with single males that are running the streets and, you know, they've historically cheated on their spouse, then you're more apt to do that. Birds of a feather flock together. No different.
That's
than just,
right.
You know, I've always said that, you know, traveling, I'm not traveling with somebody that's not, you know, committed to their spouse and their family. But, you know, in the fire service, if when you're off duty and you're watching the Super Bowl or you're fishing or doing a barbecue or whatever, you're hanging out with people that are in the fire service. And don't get me wrong, you should have a variety. You should hang out with other people. It makes it interesting for conversations. But most of the time, the conversation is going to be about you. Even if you're hanging out with an orthopedic surgeon, you know, you're hanging out with an orthopedic surgeon, they want to talk, they want to ask you about the fire service, right?
Right.
Yeah. And we're not smart enough to even know what to ask them. So it's a conversation about the fire service, but it makes it, you know, for me, I, whether it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, 4th of July, I'm hanging out with the same people I've been friends with for over 20 years. Some of them 40 years. You know, the guy across the street from me, him and I graduated high school together. He's a battalion chief at Midway. He's our computer IT guy for our conferences. We're junior firefighters together. Right behind him through the woods is my lifelong best friend. He, you know, him and I were on the rescue together, went to the Florida State Fire College 30 years ago together. And we rode the school bus, graduated high school, played on the same soccer team. Those are the people that I associate it. So when I'm off duty, we're talking about the fire service. You know, about the time you and I are done with this firefighter success podcast, my buddy Shannon Stone, that, you know, has done a lot of traveling with me, he's stopping by to pick me up so we can go look at their drill facility at Midway. This is my day off, you know. That's who I hang out with, that's who I associate with. You know, if I'm texting with somebody, it's firefighters around the country. And, you know, more so than ever before, when I was younger, you know, firefighters' wives that had just met me would say, do you know how to talk about anything but the fire service? And my answer has always been simple. No, that's what I do. I don't talk about football. I do a little bit now. Yeah, I mean, I'm into seeing how Coach Billy Napier is going to do at UF, but primarily I'm just like, you know, a guy like, you know, I'm not comparing myself to him, but, you know, I'm like, you know, somebody like Tony Robbins or John Gordon or somebody that what they do is what they're totally into it. But
yeah,
I will tell the listeners there's a drawback. I'm a boring person when it comes to talking about anything but the fire service. I really am. I'm not very educated, if you will. I'm kind of ignorant about most everything in society outside the fire service. I don't watch the news very much. I'm not into politics. You know, I'm proud to say I'm a Christian. I grew up in a Bible-based church, but even the Bible, I'm not somebody. I love reading John Sparrow's quotes and all that because it totally motivates me. And you know, I'm the guy that wakes up and not forgetting to be thankful for my prayers that were answered yesterday. But I couldn't, you know, I mean, I'm not very well versed in the Bible, even though I grew up in a Baptist church, going to church on Sunday, Wednesday, and Saturday. So, you know, even things that I'm interested or love or my faith, I'm not necessarily as educated as I'd like to be because my life has been consumed since almost elementary school with nothing but firefighting.
Right, right. Well, I love that because one of the things you said is that if you want to be the best, you have to surround yourself with the best people. And you're someone who's all in. And the fire service has been something that has been all consuming for you. And that's just that's what you live and breathe. And so as if we're wanting to go to the next level, push ourselves to our maximum potential, we really need to dive in and give that 110% commitment to what we're studying, what we're training on, and increasing our knowledge of what we need to do on the job. And one of the things you just touched on that's incredibly important to you is your family. And I'm a family man. I can tell you're a family man, and it's one of the qualities I really respect and admire about you. So if you wouldn't mind, and you touched on this a little bit, could you talk about the importance of balancing the family life and the fire life, and what are the challenges behind that?
Well, it's, it's really no different than you see in the corporate America. You know, I have to refer anybody that has not read the thing that Steve Jobs wrote before he died. It's very powerful about how much money you can have, you know, whether it's cars, you know, phones, but you can't buy more time. You know, I would say everybody should print. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about, Steve Jobs?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody exactly. should print that off and put it like in a pocket protector and put it in their desk drawer, put it in their sock drawer, because it's one of the most powerful things that I've read and reminds me that, there's going to be a last soccer game. I got very emotional. Mm. My son was the keeper. They had rode a charter bus to the East Coast, and they were multiple games into making a run for the state championship. And soccer was my life. You know, I'll share this. I'm not sure I've shared this on a podcast before. I walked off the soccer field as the varsity goalie just for a lack of emotional intelligence in high school, and I regretted it. So for my kids, you know, them choosing to play soccer has been powerful, and I can't go back and get another game with my son that's a junior in college now. It's one mm-hmm. of those things. And so balance for me is I'm still working on it, even with, you know, two kids in college, one that's a junior in high school. I'm doing better than ever before. But there's one thing that you're not going to regret, and that's spending more time with your kids, your spouse, your significant other. You're just not going to regret that. I get it. Sometimes you got to take overtime for, you know, paying the power bill. But, you know, if you're working overtime to pay for, you know, a side-by-side, pay for a boat that you really can't even use because you're working all the time to pay for it, man, just sell that thing and get time.
That's right.
If there's one thing that COVID taught us, not just in this country, but around the world, is time. COVID, I still to this day think that COVID wasn't all bad. And I think one thing that was good about COVID was making us figure out how to enjoy the four walls of your house, enjoy walking in your yard, being with your family, reconnecting, and that sometimes less is more, you know, less stuff, you know, and just enjoying a good movie with a bag of popcorn, and not that I watch TV, but those are critical things for me. You know, when my kids were younger, I missed birthday parties. I've had a take home car for 22 years. I can self dispatch to any incident or fire I want to. Early on, that was not a good thing. I didn't have the discipline to just say, "Hey, there's going to be more fires," where now I do have the discipline to maybe not leave and go to those fires. I take off, man. I'm not trying to, you know, there's, and listen up. If you're listening to this podcast, if you're maxed out on your annual leave and you got over 1,000 hours of sick leave, you're maxed out on your annual leave and you have the ability to take off on Saturday to go to your daughter's, you know, ballet or your daughter playing tennis or your, you know, son playing t-ball or whatever sport, unacceptable. I don't care how much you love the job, unacceptable. I've given this advice to numerous people that they in the fire service, we breed this thought process, even for us, or the ones that are not into the job. There's this disease in the American fire service that firefighters want to have 1,000 hours of annual leave and 1,000 hours of sick leave. And I'm not telling you to unacceptably call in sick on a holiday or call in sick when staffing is bottomed out, or, you know, just burn your leave. I get you need stuff for a rainy day, but I'm telling you, most of you, the rainy day's not coming. You're going to retire and you're going to sell back all that sick leave, all that annual leave, and your kids are going to be gone. They're going to be gone. You're going to be sitting in a lazy boy at your house, and you're going to have more money than you ever had. It's going to be flip-flopped when your kids were little and you couldn't figure out how to pay for groceries. And now
now
you have money, and it's like you're like, you know, like, you know, Buffett, you know, you how much money can you have? It's like now that's become your driving force. And so, you know, I hope it makes sense when I talk about balance is if you got leave, use it sometimes. I mean, take off. And I'm telling you that, you know, anybody that works for Scambia County Fire Rescue, they wonder when I'm coming to work. I was off 22 days. I came back, I worked five in a row, and now I'm off for 16 more days. I've maximized how to make the most out of my annual leave. I comp everything. I take comp time instead of overtime. And a lot of it is because I travel, teach. But I'm going to tell you something. I take off, like my kids now, they're, you know, in Gainesville, University of Florida. For the first time ever, I got, you know, season tickets to, you know, go watch the Gators play football. And I've been to almost every home game. I'm burning that leave because I can't get it back. There's going to be a time where my youngest 2 years from now, he's going to be gone and I'm not going to have as much of a reason. So I think everybody, you know, needs to focus on capturing those moments, those events, those times that you're never going to get back. Because you, no matter how much annual sick, drop money, 401k, deferred comp, and that is like, you know, the American Fire Service drives us to want to see how rich we can be when we're retired. How about start living life today? You know what? Yeah. And I'll finish out that question with balance is living life today with no regrets tomorrow. Living life today with no regrets tomorrow. That's on one of our stickers and our patches is live without regret. And if tomorrow you can look back and say, hey, you know what? I'm glad I took off and I went to that, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, but if you work and after, you know, whatever event goes on, your family's texting you pictures and you miss that moment, man, you're not getting that back. I mean, you can accumulate more annual and sick leave. You can't accumulate more, you know, family events, if you will.
That is so true. And it really is all about balance. And one of the things that I've had to learn over the years is that when you're off, be off, right? When you're at home, be intentional with your time, with your family. And yeah, you're going to have other things to do. But when you're home with your family, don't constantly be checking in on work, you know, seeing what calls are being run. And if you're at the level of, to where you can just leave work at work, do that as much as possible, and focus more time on your family. Cause like you said, you're never going to get that time back. You're never going to have those minutes back. So whatever time you get to spend with your family, make it count. So I want to kind of dive back into some more fire service stuff. And I know one of the things you're really passionate about is reducing civilian fire fatalities. So if you don't mind, share why this is so important to you and maybe mention some of the steps that we can really talk about or we can really do to achieve reducing civilian fire fatalities.
Well, first and foremost, you know, I got a filing cabinet, you know, in my head, just full of folders that, you know, that they're busting at the seams, just like anybody else. I don't have nightmares. I don't have bad dreams. You know, I don't feel like I have PTSD. I jump sometimes. I like my back against the wall, but I think most all first responders, fire and police officers are like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I still, you know, function to the best of my ability, but I've experienced over 50 civilian fire fatalities. I've experienced a lot of, you know, of young kids that have been put in body bags. You know, I experienced my first civilian fire fatality in 1979 as a kid. My dad was the chief. And, you know, I was actually in the back of, I've told this story a bunch of times, I was in the back of a 1971 Volvo station wagon. My mom had already left to go to work. She worked at Hurlburt Air Force Base. She left real early. My dad was at home and a fire came out as, you know, entrapment. The tally, it was only a couple of miles from our house. It was just my dad and I at home. He threw me in the car. You know, then we didn't have car seats. I just, you know, was riding in the back of a, you know, Volvo station wagon in this two-story house on Laurel Drive, which is literally just, I mean, a stone's throw down the coast on what we call the Intercoastal Waterway from where Sky, a girl that just died a few years ago that my daughter played softball with. And, you know, I was not a firefighter, but, you know, I saw him pull a middle-aged man out of a two-story house fire. So I put him in a body bag. I asked my dad why they put that man in a bag, you know? And I've just been, you know, plagued and been on duty at the wrong time, it seems like my whole career. Every fire department I've worked for, you know, I've responded to fire fatalities. When I started at Escambia County Fire Rescue, I was a countywide safety training captain. I went to all fires. We had 21 civilian fire fatalities in a little over a year.
Wow.
That's saturation rate is out of control. You know, I've been to fires where, you know, I've heard people screaming. You know, obviously the kids get you more, whether it's burglar bars, hoarding conditions, no smoke detectors. And I'll say this, you know, when fire prevention fails, we cannot fail. And, you know, smoke detectors are huge. Out of the 50 plus civilian fire fatalities that have impacted my thought process, my passion, my purpose, my motivation to eliminate them, you know, as much as I can, I've never been to one or experienced one that there was an operational smoke detector. And that's for you listening. Do firefighters, man, there's firefighters that don't have operational smoke detectors in their house.
Right, right.
You know, and I grew up, my father was selling Master Guard smoke alarms. He's like steel smoke alarms in the 70s when nobody had them. So I grew up with smoke alarms in my house. We actually had one when I was a kid that had a chain hanging from it, kind of like you'd see in like a kitchen of a, you know, a restaurant where you just pulled the chain, you know, down. Like, I don't think very many people grew up our age having that, but that was just, my dad was a fire prevention guy. My dad had some bad fires that, you know, were kids and families burn up. So I grew up, loved going to fires, love fighting fires, but I can tell you that I'm a huge, huge proponent, advocate, supporter of fire prevention.
Yes. Yes.
Smoke detectors, sprinkler systems. My dad made me my first paid job. I was a fire inspector, city of Mary Esther by Fort Walton Beach in Destin. I was a fire inspector. And you know, my dad right out of high school made me become get certified as an arson investigator, a fire inspector, all the other stuff. And my dad just, you know, he wanted me to have something to be able to fall back on if I got hurt and I couldn't ride the rigs. But he also believed that to be the best firefighter, you had to understand, you know, the whole aspect of, you know, engineering, enforcement, inspections, and that sort of thing. So it's just the 50 plus civilian fire fatalities and not wanting to go to another fire where somebody dies, you know, just for no good reason. A smoke detector and they'd be alive. Just, you know, that's the biggest thing. And how do we get it below 2000? It really just comes down to being committed long term, day in and day out, always be on duty. Have your gear ready, have your air pack ready, have your thermal imager with a fully charged battery. Not be that firefighter now that doesn't want to carry a light on a sling. Like, everybody in the fire service now just thinks a little light hook to their coat's good enough. You got to have one of those Vulcan lights or whatever brand light you like that's on a sling that's hanging down by your waist, that when you're down below the smoke or you're on your knees where it's the highest probability of visibility, which is becoming less and less based on today's combustible, you know, the products of combustion are so nasty, but just little things like that so you don't miss it. And having the answers when the test comes. Everybody has the answers to the test until it's time to take the test. Well, the test is going to be at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
At 2 o'clock in the morning when you're amped up, do you know based on where the garage is, what direction you need to go left and right? Or do you just always go right? Or do you just always go opposite the way the door swings? So it's easy to know what to do when you're sitting at the coffee table, but are you doing that at a fire? Targeted searches. Rural and suburban America has to get on board immediately with targeted searches.
Yeah.
We refer to that as VES, VEIS. I don't care what you call it. Targeted searches. You're targeting the highest probable location of trapped victims, backed up by the highest probability of survivability based on firefighter rescue survey. Everybody's got to be filling out the firefighter rescue survey. That's thousands of grabs, if you will. Regardless if they survive, we still need to know when you got there. What was your tactical function? All those things are going to give us information to be better at targeted searches. It's going to back up my belief of the booster backup. 90% of the fire service, 90% of the fire service should be sending the first two fire trucks directly to the scene of a single family private dwelling. It's not even up for debate. What's the other 10%? FDNY, Chicago, you know, maybe Atlanta. Fire departments that are running fully staffed engines and trucks out of the same firehouse. And they're still going to the scene because the truck and the engine go straight in. But in suburban America, county fire departments, city fire departments that run one company out of a firehouse, you need the second company coming in to give you enough people to stretch a line to, you know, maintain and create survivable space and get those targeted searches. To have the second rig catch a hydrant before you've even started water, you're killing people. There are civilians buried 6 feet under all across the United States because the second arriving apparatus stopped to catch a hydrant. I don't care if it only takes 30 seconds. 30 seconds can be the difference between life and death. And we have to buy in to the fast attack, the tank attack, understanding the UL stuff that, you know, out of 25 real burns and real buildings, the most water ever used was 225 gallons of water out of all those fires that you see that were done for the UL burns. Most of the time, less than 200 gallons. Even the two-story townhouse, very impressive fire at the burns in Cobb County, Georgia, the most water was 225 gallons. And that's how we're going to get the civilian fire fatalities down, because fire prevention has plateaued off. It's leveled off. Don't get me wrong. I got multiple copies. I got my dad's copy of America Burning from, you know, nearly 50 years ago. Now that book's been out, you know, over 8,000, over 10,000 civilian fire. And we've gotten it down to where we're below 3,000, but we're not below 2,000 yet. And so when fire prevention fails, and I'm not saying it fails all the way around, it's just, it's not getting that. That's where we have to operationally step up our game. And if we're going to operationally continue to do the same thing, we're going to continue to get the same result. And if your fire department's going to fires and you're having a civilian, even if you just have one a year, one every 2 years, and the house is not completely 100% fully involved in arrival, you got to ask yourself, if we'd got here 30 seconds quicker, if the second rig would have came straight to the scene, if we tactically deployed where search was simultaneous with fire attack, would this person, that person be alive today? We've got to be targeting our searches. And then once we find them, removing them, are we adequate? Are we effective and efficient at our techniques of removing, you know, unconscious victims inside a fire environment to the exterior? And then once outside, are we putting the same effort, energy, you know, dedication, commitment, skills, and abilities to reviving them that we do for an 85-year-old in a nursing home? The answer most of the time is no. You know, we'll go to an 85-year-old in a nursing home and we'll send an ambulance, a fire truck, a supervisor, and we'll shock them, we'll break all their ribs, we'll run a bunch of drugs, but we'll pull a 14-year-old out of a house fire because there's soot all over their face. We're just like, they're dead. When we just really probably need to do some basic BLS, and they could be awake talking to us in 5 minutes. I've seen it happen a bunch of times. And I could talk about this for an hour, so I'll leave it at that. it's just, you know, why am I so committed to getting the civilian fire fatality rate down? Because I've had some bad fires that just sucked. And I do think we can make a difference. We do make a difference. Just because your chief, your captain, your organization has never had a successful rescue at a house fire does not mean it's not happening every day. Our friend Brian Brush, one of the top innovators, motivators, leaders, consistent in the fire service, a guy that understands balance, everything you've asked, you should be interviewing Brian Brush, not me, is, you know, he came up with 9.8 rescues a day when he was working on his master's for Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma. And that's huge. 9.8 rescues a day every day. But we have leaders in the fire service, or so-called leaders. They might be leaders, they're just not fire service leaders. And to back up that earlier, there is a difference. You can have somebody that works for the fire department that's a leader. They're just not a firefighter leader or a leader of firefighters or a fire service leader. Yeah, they can be a leader in corporate America, but they suck when it comes to leading a fire company, a battalion, or a fire department. Because a fire service leader would be driving firefighters to be the best they can at oriented search. rescue and removal of an unconscious trapped occupant that is completely naked with hydrocarbon residual smoke on their skin that's like oil or like Dawn dish soap, and you've trained your folks on how to do that. And then when you get them outside, you know, is your organization carrying the drugs that's going to give them the highest probability of, you know, circulation and a sustainable life? So those are things that we as a fire service have to look at. And all you got to do is, you know, like Grant Schwabel does that Firefighter Grab podcast, or look at Firefighter Rescue Survey, follow it on Facebook, social media, the website, and just communicating with people. Yesterday, Anthony Rowett, captain of Mobile, Alabama, I get texts all the time from people, and I love it when they share it with me. They rescued an adult autistic guy in a working fire in Mobile, Alabama yesterday. We here in Northwest Florida, in Fort Walton Beach, Ocean City, Wright, Midway, Navarre, we've had rescues and successful grabs where people walked out of the hospital, lived and survived in the last 10 years, that the 10 years before that would have been dead. 20 years ago, they'd have definitely been dead. Why? A change in culture, a culture of search, a change in aggressive is not bad. Training, thermal imaging cameras, all of targeted searches. You know, VES 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even today in some places is referred to as an FDNY, you know, urban tactic. And I challenge you, I have a column in Firehouse Magazine, Command Success, front part of the magazine, three times a year. One of my columns is on targeted searches and one of Lloyd Mitchell's pictures, the FDNY using a ground ladder going in the second floor with a hose line, a water can, and a ground ladder. That's suburban tactics there. A ground ladder, a three-quarter, and a water can. Happens to be a firefighter in Brooklyn doing it, but every suburban firefighter should know how to throw a 24-foot ladder or a 28-foot ladder, how to take a line up a ladder into a bedroom, into a, you know, whatever game room, and when to use a water can, when to use a hose line to provide the best outcome for any occupants that are trapped, and provide us a level or a margin of safety.
So much good stuff there. And we could really talk about that forever. But one of the things that you really brought up that you touched on that I want to go deeper into is talking about training specifically. And yes, you know, fire prevention has definitely a huge impact, but we need to make sure that we're training and that we are operationally sound, as you mentioned, so that we can give them the best possible chance of survival. So I first want to talk about county fire tactics. So if someone's been living under the rock for the last 10 years or whatever, you know, and they have no idea what county fire tactics is all about, could you please educate them on that and let us know how it came about? And I also want to talk about the conferences that you offer, but let everybody know about county fire tactics and how it got started.
You know, obviously they can go, you know, spelled fully out, countyfiretactics.com or on social media, CFT fire, you know, fire operations. We got hacked under CF Tactics and lost 57,000 followers, but I didn't lose any sleep. We just moved forward. But County Fire Tactics, you know, .com, that's a website. But, you know, and I'm going to write a book, and my book's title is going to be County Fire Tactics. That's going to be the title of my, you know, book if I live long enough. And I'm just not going to take time to do a book right now when I got a youngest. It's a junior in high school. I've always said once my youngest has gone off to college and it's just Jessica and I, that's when I'll work on the, you know, making the county fire tactics book happen. And county fire tactics, it's not a website. It's not fire conferences. County fire tactics is that. It's fire tactics that you use in a county setting, a county fire department. And what is county fire tactics? It's rural, suburban, and urban environments that are protected by a diverse staffing model. It's what Escambia County is. It's what Orange County or Palm Beach County, Florida is, or LA County, California. You know, there's counties all over the country, DeKalb County, Georgia, Prince George County, Montgomery County, Maryland. Those county fire tactics is, you know, and it's not called a county fire department, but the largest land-wise city in the country is Jacksonville, Florida. Duval County, like you're going down I-10, you pass Tallahassee, and it's like you get to Jacksonville, and it seems like you got 100 miles to go before you get to downtown Jacksonville where they have a stadium. They have a football team, but I don't know if they really show up on Sundays or not. but at the end of the day, you know, Jacksonville has stations, you know, like out towards the outer skirts of Duval County that are two people on a tanker. But if you go to downtown city of Jacksonville where the high rises are, they ride, you know, four on a tiller, you know, four on an engine company and a chief running out of a firehouse. But the people working in the two station department, they still work for Jacksonville Fire Rescue, a very historic, great fire department. But the reality is if you work for the city of Jacksonville, you have to do county fire tactics, depending where you are. And I think county fire tactics encompasses, once again, 90% of the fire service where, you know, sometimes you're running away from companies, sometimes you're running towards companies. And that's where we as the fire service, there's not an exact fix-all. You definitely got to know, you know, what I think is the foundational book for fireground operations would be John Norman's Fire Officer Handbook.
Right.
A lot of other great books, you know, Fornell's, you know, Firestream Management, you know, Chief Clark's Methods and Techniques book. But, you know, when you read Chief Norman's, you know, John Norman's Fire Officer Handbook, phenomenal foundation. But what I put a spin on to, you know, literally when I went to Escambia County 22 years ago is what I refer to as time delayed tactics. So I read John Norman's Fire Officer Handbook. I know it cover to cover. I go to a fire like I did day before yesterday. On Facebook, I posted a little video that the first arriving ladder truck caught me, you know, full gear, air pack, two hands, two tools, as Champo says, thermal imager and a light. Well, I'm the second arriving chief. I'm running towards that, you know, fire building, but you don't see any other firefighters really operating in that thing. So I'm a firefighter right now. I can't like go stand next to two other chiefs when there's nobody to get, you know, tactics done because tactics put out fires. So when I got to that building day before yesterday, just like the other fires that I had, I got to see what can I do now with the people I have right now that is the closest thing to what I like to refer to as foundational tactics. What I would refer to as like, you know, FDNY tactics or Chicago tactics, tactics that have been successful in large urban apartments, you know, for decade after decade after decade. But how do we do it when our rigs are showing up spread across, you know, sometimes, you know, 8, 10, maybe even 15 minutes, depending on your organization. So that's where county fire tactics came from. Then, I guess probably, man, it's probably been over 15 years ago now, I purchased the domain name, countyfiretactics.com. DJ Stone, Shannon Stone's brother, actually got the website up and running for me. It was Mickey Mouse for over, you know, a decade. I did it from my phone. It looked like a third grader was running it. And now we have Scott Slocum out of South Florida that runs a website for us. So the website has evolved, you know, more into something, but it's, I'm being long-winded, but I want everybody to understand that County Fire Tactics is not about countyfiretactics.com. It's really a thought process of you learning the foundational tactics from solid textbooks dating back to Chief Freed's Red Tactics book of the 70s, and then figuring out how you can apply it based on your staffing, your response model. And then with that, yes, we have a series of CFT fire conferences that we're very proud of, large number of people. You know, my wife, Jessica, she was a third grade school teacher for a little while, but she full-time runs the registration and manages the administrative side of me travel speaking and the conferences. But the team of CFT people is huge. I mean, it's way over 50. And we have, you know, this December will be the last HROC high-rise operations conference, but we will still have HROC as a high-rise operations class at other conferences. It'll be more of a seminar type thing where it'll be a smaller number, more concentrated, where it's almost like it'll become something for people that have been to the original HROCs, but now we're going to a new level just based on, like, we just got back from spending 10 days in Europe, London, with over a half a dozen other countries represented. But, you know, the fire conferences on Pensacola Beach, those were founded. The real truth is, why did the fire conferences come about? 2009, our fire chief was fired. I was the acting deputy chief. I was put back to my battalion chief role. And I was told by Escambia County administrator that I needed to just come to work, do my shift, and find something else to do. 2000 to 2009, I lived at Escambia County Fire Rescue, running the training division, doing classes, stuff like that. And I, that was all came to a halt on February 23rd, 2009. So I was used to running like conferences and seminars under the umbrella of Escambia County Fire Rescue. So my wife supported, hey, let's start doing our own seminars, our own conferences, so you can teach and you can fund bringing your fellow friends, mentors, instructors to Pensacola Beach to do cost-effective training. Not to offend anybody, Jessica, my wife, had already been listening to me for over a decade, dating back into the 90s, complaining about when I went to a fire conferences or what I thought they were not doing right, what they could do better, things they weren't, that I thought were costing attendees unnecessary funds, that the money they were spending wasn't going in the pocket of the people that were running the conference. So I wouldn't have had a problem with that. And just a tidbit for you guys that are into the job listening, it's okay to make money. It's okay to get paid to run a you know, write a book and sell a book to firefighters, run a podcast, run a seminar, teach, you know, not to get off track, Jim, but I got to say this, because in a fire service, you can make money laying tile, building fences, building houses, pressure washing. It's okay to make money doing anything, but God forbid somebody makes money off of teaching firefighting, you know, running a fire related podcast, selling fire, you know, swag, t-shirts. You would think that was the biggest sin in the world. And it's not, because all you're doing is making the job better. You're making yourself better. And now your side job has to do with your primary job, to where everybody's benefiting.
That's right.
The conferences came about, you know, I wanted it to be where we do what we do. We go around and all we do is we ask the restaurants, will you give a discount? That way firefighters don't have to ask. And, you know, a wristband to signify. We provide the free shuttle to and from the airport. We're the only conference on Pensacola Beach that you get free parking. You don't have to pay to park your car at the Hilton. And that was just because I negotiated it. I don't get any money. At the end of the day, though, if firefighters have to come and pay $15 a day for 5 days, that's $75 that the Hilton's getting. And all I had to do is negotiate with them, and they don't have to pay for that.
We
organize where everybody's going, and then we communicate with the establishments that they're going to have enough people, so it's a good experience outside of the classroom. We make sure that we get vetted speakers and instructors. We historically open all of our conferences early at a lower price, so somebody that's pulling out their personal credit card is paying that lower price. When we first started, it was $99, then it was $150. Now it's basically about $200. That's, you know, and then as time goes on, the price goes up. So and that's why we don't give out a lot of information early on, because, you know, the municipalities, the fire departments, they got to have a bunch of details and all this before they're going to write spend department money. And that's when the cost goes up. So they help foot the bill, so the firefighters paying out of pocket don't have to pay as much. The fire department's training budgets are making it where everybody can attend a conference and not go bankrupt trying to, you know, go to a conference. And when they leave, they feel like they got more than they gave. And so that's, you know, that's kind of our business model, if you will, is we like to advertise, under promise and over deliver. And we want people to leave with a great experience and feel like they didn't spend or waste any, you know, unnecessary money. And, you know, if anybody's listening, you know, we do the CFT 100, where your fire department pays a one flat rate of $1,000, and they get a seat at every conference, and they don't even have to decide who they're going to send till a week before. And that's turned out to be awesome for the training divisions that just don't know, but they can lock in those spots. And now we have firefighters coming to conferences on Pensacola Beach, the fire department's paying the bill that otherwise wouldn't get that training. So at the end of the day, we got to make money. You know, Jessica and I, it's her full-time job. Yes, we have to have a level of income to make it worth, because it's a family event, man. It consumes our families, you know, a lot of our time. Sometimes our house looks like hoarding conditions in our office, you know, swag. And I wasn't into swag. I was against it at first. Shannon Stone, who's on his way to pick me up, you know, he got it going. And now the swag, we sell shirts and hoodies, and we do finally, we weren't making money at first, because you for every one you give away, you got to sell two to make pay for the one you gave away. But, but we are making revenue now. We're making money off of shirts, coins. And at the end of the day, that allows us to still survive given the conferences, up the quality some so we can have, you know, a live music at night and do those bonus things that aren't expected, because really what's expected is you'd be able to have a good speaker, you get an education, but we like the additional stuff while we still can meet the income that we need. So I could keep talking about it, but you know, the most important thing is CFT Fire Conferences would not exist, you know, first and foremost, without my wife, Jessica, and her working on something 7 days a week. She's doing something CFT registration wise. But the team of CFT people, which is well over 50, and we've been doing it now for, I guess we're going on our 13th year.
Wow, that is awesome. And every time I hear someone coming back from it and, you know, posting it, seeing people post about it on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, nothing but accolades and that they had a great time training. And you're right. Every time someone describes it, it's more of a family environment, and it's not a huge grandiose conferences that you offer, but it is more intimate and definitely a lot more time for fellowship and just talking about the job, loving the job. And like you said, getting to train and learn and become better at our jobs. And which is a great segue for my next question. I really want to ask you is, and we could talk about this for 8 hours, but what are the fundamentals of great training?
The reality is just, realistic, you know, relevant, you know, those are the biggest things, just relevant and realistic. It doesn't have to be a labyrinth. Sometimes just literally taking the time at the coffee table to just look at a picture or, you know, pull up a previous fire you had, you know, as long as it's clean. I mean, I get into carcinogens and all that, but, you know, just pulling a rip bag out and sitting it on the kitchen table and just going and talking about the rip bag, you know, talking about how to cut somebody's bunker gear off, you know, getting out a rope bag and talking about different things. So it does not have to be this elaborate thing. It's just a little bit, you know, you talk about the white book outliers, you know, what is it? 10,000 hours. To be an expert at something. Well, if everybody put in 1 hour a shift on a 24-hour shift, that's just it. 1 hour of some type of fire service, you know, training, and you worked 100 shifts in a year, that's 100 hours. 10 years, that's 1,000 hours outside of your 40-hour programs and all that. It really would be scary to know how good we could be as a fire service if every firefighter, every company, every fire department truly just did an hour on duty each 24-hour shift or tour. It's not complex, man. Like, just think about when somebody the first time they get on a good door prop with a good instructor, and you just do 1 hour on a door prop where they were before and after 1 hour on a door prop. You know, that's it. Just realistic and relevant. It, you know, and I think so many times, you know, company officers or chiefs, they're working too hard to razzle and dazzle somebody instead of just keeping it, you know, simplistic. That's it. You know, getting a hydrant bag and walking out to the hydrant in front of the firehouse. That's it. You know, just keep it, you know, simplistic. Get you a list of things. And I, you know, obviously probably the big thing is most people always want to fall back on what they're comfortable with. If they're into pump operations, they're going to do pump operations. They're in the door, you know, forcing doors, is make sure you're not always doing the same thing. And I'll tell you this, don't be worried about firefighters not liking it. I mean, even the biggest dud, if delivered properly, you don't ridicule them, you don't embarrass them. And when they're done, they're able to shine and improve their skills at whatever it is. They like it. Everybody likes training if they're not embarrassed or ridiculed. It's just, you got to build them in. The psychology of, you know, delivery is important. So, there's no excuse for somebody not drilling, like saying, oh, I don't know what to drill on. And I got to say this before we move on, is, you know, make sure that you're thinking a little more complex. And, you know, I say it a lot when I travel around. I get it. Everybody wants to do VES on a first floor window with the 5-pound, you know, baby made out of towels from the hotel room, but are you training on a second floor window with a full size rescue Randy? Or get or shed? Are you training on the third floor window with the rescue Randy? You know, where you got to cut some burglar bars or cut some hurricane glass, and the smoke machine's going wide open, and you're using a 24-foot ladder that's like steeper than 75 degrees, where it's got to be tied off, and somebody's holding it, and you got to operate like you're the painter, you know, operating on it. You know, we did we had that vacant Best Western a couple of years ago. And we had a third floor VES prop built into the Best Western on Pensacola Beach. And, you know, that was literally, I'm was so proud and excited. I just stood there and watched. I wasn't even teaching. I'm just a, you know, watching. And I'm like, man, this is VES training here. If somebody can go up a ground ladder to the third floor, go into, you know, zero visibility, even if it's theatrical smoke, and rescue a legitimate rescue dummy, they can obviously do a first floor targeted VES search. So those are things that we as a fire service have to up the game a little bit, make it a little bit, you know, you got to walk before you can run, but we got to eventually start running. And there is a time and a place to run on a fire ground. You know, I ran on a fire ground day before yesterday because it did matter. You know, there's the first due engine company's inside and it's getting nasty quick. And I got to evaluate, you know, do they need to come out? Do they need to stay in? Where's the fire? What's going on? And 10 seconds could make the difference.
Wow. That is so true. I love that you brought up realistic, relevant. And then I'm going to add one more to your two R's. Get those reps in. So that's the third R, is make sure you get those reps in day by day. And as you said, that could be an hour per 24-hour shift. Even if you only have 15 minutes to dedicate to something, just do it. So you get that repetition day after day after day. So what would you say we should be training on more? You know, you mentioned, you know, shooting high and having high expectations with your training, but also keeping it simple and finding that balance. But what are one or two things that we definitely need to be training on more?
Well, you know, if speaking to training officers and training chiefs, first and foremost, you got to have a plan, you know, you got to have a plan, and there's got to be some emotional intelligence in a plan. Like I said earlier, my buddy Shannon Stone, you know, he's just arrived here to pick me up, to take me up to Midway to look at a project he's been working on for a few years now. You got to, let's go back to question one. If you're a training officer, a training chief, you got to be in it for the long game. You got to have that longevity. It can't be about, you know, trying to produce results next week. So talking to training officers and training chiefs, you're going to have a long-term plan. And if you're obsessed with the job, as much as we complain in the fire service about how people in the training division are just there for promotion, they're not into the job, they don't give a shit, I'm going to tell you what can be just as big of a problem is put a guy like me in the training division, and then I don't have the proper emotional intelligence, I don't have a long-term plan, I don't have somebody, you know, putting a leash on me to realize that I can't make everybody, you know, in whatever fire department that I'm working for, you know, be the next, you know, phenomenal firefighter. It's just going to fail. It's got to be, you know, palatable for the majority. So, you know, those are things. And right now, because if somebody's listening to this, they're probably into the job. So, if you're into the job and you get the fortunate opportunity, because it is an opportunity to change your organization, you know, like a Shannon Stone or a Brian Brush, Kyle Romagus, you know, I got so excited when he went in the training division over there in Texas. When guys like that get in the training division that were firefighters or into the job, it is awesome as long as they do like those guys and they understand that everybody that they're going to train is not going to be into it like them, and understand there's going to be people that are against them and you're looking to capture them a year or two from now. Results take time. You know, I said earlier, like outside of fire service, you know, Florida Gators paid $17 million for Coach Mullen to walk away last year because he wasn't producing winning results. Well, Coach Billy Napier shows up from the Raging Cajuns, you know, coached under Nick Saban. We're three games into his being a brand new coach at the Florida Gators and the SEC, and the alumni is calling for him to be fired. Like, really? I mean,
three games in.
Yeah. And a guy told him before he came there, he said, you know, this is going to take me years. The first year that Nick Saban was a coach at Alabama, he lost to like Louisiana Tech or somebody, like a team nobody's ever even heard of. And so that goes just with the training division and in a fire service. You know, and a lot of times when I give advice, it's because, you know, I didn't take the advice or I didn't live the advice that I'm given. So I've learned a lot of stuff the hard way by making a lot of mistakes. The one thing I feel like that I, you know, with a lot of help from a lot of people that I did do right is how we built the fire conferences. And it goes with this last question you're asking me is, you know, advice to training officers and captains is we didn't try to do a 3-day fire conference flowing water off the 17th floor right off the bat. We had some 1-day seminars, some 2-day seminars. We involved people that had traveled around the country and gone to a bunch of different fire conferences. And we got a team of people that everybody's voice was respected. And that's what training officers and training chiefs have to do too, is they got to get some respected voices still working on the rigs and the line to back and support the training division. That's going to be your most powerful thing. And then, you know, I always like to say it. I love, you know, from Rob Fisher, 10 pounds of pressure 100% of the time, and you're going to win. You know, Coach Billy Napier is going to win a national championship as the coach of the University of Florida. It's just going to be about 3 or 4 years from now when he's coaching his team. He's got depth on the bench, and his investment has had time to let the concrete dry, if you will.
So good. So advice for those training officers out there, company officers who want to train your people, have a plan. Remember that results take time and build off your small successes. Not every single person you train is going to become a rock star. And again, like you said before, Chief, consistency, 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 time and time again. Well, Chief, thanks for coming on the Firefighter Success Podcast. Let everybody know how they can get in touch with you and remind them again how to register for the Fire Conference 2023, your website, anything else you'd like to add.
First of all, if you're still listening, then that means if you listen this long that you love the job. So thanks for loving the job. We just need one more person to love the job. Go to countyfiretactics.com, countyfiretactics.com. Everything's on there. There's any pictures, video you want to use, right-click them, share them. Nothing's copyrighted. We got videos from fires that we've had. At the top left, whether you're on your phone or a computer, there's a little hamburger, the little lines. Click on it. A menu bar drops down for the 2022 fire conferences, 2023 fire conferences, CFT 100. If you click on About CFT, it'll pull up my whole page with all my podcasts. This one will be on there. My articles has my email address, my personal phone number, Jessica's email address, so you can contact us there. And we hope to see you. Atrox basically almost sold out. We got less than 20 spots left. But the fire conference, January 30th to February 4th, is going to be out of this world. 5 days, over a dozen speakers, instructors, with John Norman leading the County Fire Tactics Officer Development Program.
Ooh, that's going to be awesome. That's going to be awesome. And to all those out there listening, stay fit, stay safe, and remember, when lives depend on us, success is our only option. Thanks for listening to the Firefighter Success Podcast. Go to firefightersuccessbook.com to learn more about the book, Firefighter Success, 20 C's to Firefighter Excellence. At the website, you can also download the free special report, 101 Rules for Firefighter Success.